Welcome to a slightly delayed February edition of Dresbert. I am Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and I write the Spoiler Alerts blog for the Washington Post.
And I'm Heather Hobart, project director at New America, and welcome to the special contest edition, Get Your Alcoholic Beverage of Choice Ready, because we are going to lead off with Hillary Clinton and her State Department emails. And your excitement is twofold. Number one, take a drink every time I roll my eyes. Number two, see if my eyes get stuck in the back of my head. Like your mother always warned you, don't do that with your face or it will get stuck that way.
Now, I will interject here and note that I have had to twist Heather's arm to talk about this. I believe the other topics that Heather might have wanted to talk about before this was the Blurred Lines video, the dress color, anything but this topic. But
are you referring to the Blurred Lines bar mitzvah invitation video, by the way?
No, I was referring to the lawsuit that was just settled yesterday, where it turns out that the writers Farrell and Alan Fixkid have to pay Marvin Gaye's estate $7.5 million. Because they apparently stole Marvin Gaye's lyrics.
See, that I'm happy to talk about. That's a real thing.
Nice try. Sticking with Clinton.
No. I do also recommend, and you can find it in my Twitter feed. Or no, maybe not. I didn't put it on Twitter. Sorry. Only on Facebook. So some child somewhere in the United States family hired a videographer to do a video invitation to his bar mitzvah consisting of sort of tweaked versions of popular songs. So instead of Royals, you have Spoiled, and it just goes on from there. And it's both hilariously funny and sort of yet another step in the downfall of our civilization, including Blurred Lines with a naked, chubby 12-year-old.
Okay. Oh, God,
yeah,
I just had to stop.
Unsee that.
Yeah, thank you very much. You know, the only thing you've succeeded in doing that is that now I actually want to talk. About Clinton and the email. So we are talking a day after Hillary Clinton's first, quasi-candidate press conference that she held in the United Nations, of all settings, after she had given a speech to mark the 20th anniversary of the Beijing Women's Summit. I don't think the press conference went all that well, but I will serve it up on a platter to you. Why do you not want to talk about this?
Well, I was going to serve it back to you. So thrust and parry, which is, can you explain to me why anyone should care that, well, no, I'll just stop there. I won't even make my case. I'll let you go first. Seriously, what about this story is of importance to anyone?
I think there are a few concerns. One concern is security, which was, since Hillary Clinton engaged in all of her correspondence using a private email server, her quote homebrewed unquote server that she set up the day of her Senate confirmation hearings, the question naturally arises: to what extent was her emails vulnerable to being hacked?
Great. So can we pause right there? Do you share that depth of concern about every Secretary of State before her? Since John Kerry is the first Secretary of State to have a state.gov email address. So if this is a huge security concern for Hillary Clinton, why was it not a huge security concern for Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Madeleine Albright? I could go on, but you get
right.
The idea.
I would say two answers to that. The first is that I think as these bureaucracies have relied more and more on email, over time it becomes more of a security concern. And second, let's be blunt, none of those other people are running for president in 2016.
At least two of the people I named were talked about as presidential contenders while they were Secretary of State. Plus,
okay,
I also want to point out that Chuck Hagel's Gmail address was tweeted by someone this morning. So, if you want to show outrage about the security of elected officials' emails, it's nothing special about Hillary Clinton. So, okay, second reason.
The second reason is that she's running for why is this an issue? The second issue is the extent to which she complied with the question of basically archiving the emails. And the press conference yesterday did not give any confidence to that, because essentially there's a third reason, which I'll get into. But the second, she basically said, okay, there were about 60,000 emails. I turned over all the ones that I thought were pertaining to the State Department. I deleted all the personal emails that had to do with Chelsea's wedding or yoga schedules. That was priceless. You know, correspondence with my husband and so on and so forth. And then when asked, was any independent person review those? The answer was they were essentially already, actually, I got contradictory answers. I couldn't tell if she was saying she wouldn't release them or that they were already deleted. Ergo, there's no way you can get to them.
Okay. I have a quiz for you. Okay. How many emails did Colin Powell turn over at the end of his tenure as Secretary of State when he was asked?
Sounds like you know the answer to this question already. So I'm
don't.
No.
The answer is zero. Zero. He refused to turn over any emails.
Okay.
Are you outraged? Do you think that's a serious problem for American historiography and democracy? Do you suspect him of hiding something?
I sure
as hell like to see Colin Powell's emails from before the Iraq War, wouldn't you?
Would love to see Colin Powell's emails.
So don't hold Hillary to a different standard. Don't suddenly discover that Hillary did something wrong that you don't think is a problem, that Colin Powell did it. And I don't know, by the way, how many the other... And my other question for you, which I don't know the answer to, but in general, when cabinet members step down and are asked to turn over relevant emails from personal accounts, is there, under any administration, has anyone ever had an independent figure...
I already answered the question. I have no idea. And this is not, you know.
Right. So why is it a problem that Hillary Clinton didn't do something that, as far as we know, no elected official, no appointed official has either done or been asked to do?
For two reasons. Again, the first one being she's running for president. So, you know, this becomes a slightly different standard that she's being held to. And if you want to say it's unfair, that's fine.
Well, it's a standard that you're making up as you go along is my only point.
But that's life in the big city.
Right, and life in the big city is that I point out that you're making up the standard issue.
Not making it up. I'm telling you why it's played out.
Dan, we are talking about this because you wanted to talk about it, so you are contributing to the sort of media frenzy here. So,
but the second reason is that essentially the answer she gave, the fundamental answer she gave, which I simultaneously believe and is also a problem for her, is that she basically said that she didn't open up a State Department email account because it was convenient for her to keep it everything on one machine.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, which sounds weird to those of us who have multiple email accounts on one device, but my understanding is that the State Department at the time, that would have been impossible. So that is an entirely fair point.
As someone who has struggled with the State Department's information, I mean, this is the other piece about all of this. I have to say that the idea that a homebrew server was less secure than the State Department servers, which get hacked on a regular basis. I've kind of been laughing that, and that is a terrible, significant, real problem that nobody seems to care enough about civilian infrastructure, internet security. But
actually, apparently the State Department's Inspector General just released a report about the State Department's email archives, and they're apparently not terribly great either, which would also be a data point.
That doesn't shock me even.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it also feeds into a narrative that is out there that essentially Hillary Clinton, is a privileged person in the sense of this was convenient for her, ergo that's the way she did it. Whereas for those of us who are grunts who have occasionally worked in government, we would not have this option, or this option would not necessarily, occur to us, which is, I think, why, by the way, there was initially a fair amount of sort of surprise about this among the sort of low-level grunt workers, and it feeds into this perception that Hillary has, aided and abetted about how she thinks of herself as being someone who's been put upon and yet actually leads this life of privilege.
Well, so a couple of things. Again, I just want to point out that the reason that this is, quote, a problem is that people who have media platforms, even us with our cute little dinky media platform here, repeat it and say that it's important. So we can't just say, oh, it's important because people are saying that it's important.
It's a passive construction, but I do think let me put it this way. I think it's a meme that resonates. So,
what I want to push back on is I don't know a single person, myself included, and I'm counting on you to visit me in jail, Dresner, if I go to jail for this. But
I will.
Of course you deleted stuff off of your White House email. You know, I mean, you know, I thought it was all archived anyway, and that nothing I deleted was going to be gone. And you could go to Little Rock and look up, you know, the time that my friend sent me dirty jokes, and or the times I got into fights with my husband on my work email. But I certainly tried to delete them. And so tell me, every employee anywhere that there's sure. internet security. So this idea that, oh, she had access, you know, whatever. And then second, again, it's not apparent to me, given what I've said about other secretaries of state, you know, Chuck Hagel's Gmail. And I don't want to pick on Chuck Hagel because I assume, I mean, in some cases I know, and in other cases I assume, everybody who had a personal email before they went into government, unless you're Barack Obama and your staff confiscate your BlackBerry. So it's just not the case that she had some kind of special privilege that others at her level didn't have.
Right.
You know?
No, that's an entirely fair point. And again, it's not like the Republican candidates for president lack in any way in terms of privilege as well. I actually think this has something to do with the fact that for some reason, it might be the case that more of the GOP candidates are better at finessing this question than Clinton has been.
I don't know, because they don't have quite as much media howling over them all the time, and because they don't have everyone saying, oh, that's typical Jeb Bush. You mean he decided which one of his emails he's going to reveal? That's just how Jeb Bush, there he goes again. That's just how Jeb Bush is, you know? No one's doing that. That's just how Scott Walker is. You don't hear the media doing that.
Actually, let me put it this way. I think you're going to find very few Republicans sympathetic to the notion that somehow the mainstream media deck is stacked against Hillary and in favor of the GOP candidate.
You know, that's not what I said. That's
okay.
Not at all what I said. I think there are ways it's stacked for Hillary and there are ways it's stacked against her. This is true
okay,
of any candidate. And so you gotta play to your strengths, and you also gotta point out where it's stacked against you. That's what's the phrase you used a little while ago?
You know, that's the
that's beanbag.
No, that's the line I always use now is from The Godfather Part Two, where Hyman Roth says, "This is the business we've chosen."
Yes.
No, I think I really do think it actually applies really well to a lot of this stuff, which is to say, is it unfair? Yeah, occasionally it's unfair. I'm not going to lie. But if you want to run for president, this is the business you've chosen.
All right. Now that we have thoroughly invoked The Godfather, before we get around to horse heads, can we move on to Iran now?
Yes, we can. Well, I'm trying to think of any other thing I want to say about Hillary. The way I would put it, I think actually Ben White, who writes for Politico, I think had a great way. He had a very pithy tweet that sort of summarizes this, which is to say, on the one hand, I don't think Clinton will ever be able to provide an adequate explanation that will appease her critics, because her critics are implacable, and because some of the questions that have been raised, you know, they're just, you know, vaguely troubling if this bothers you. On the other hand, I do completely agree that I'm not sure that's all that big of a deal down the road. I suppose what's telling, though, is that this is a story that in some ways could have potentially died after one news cycle and, you know, has been going on for at least a week. And that in and of itself is interesting. And I actually haven't abetted it all that much, but a lot of people have.
Well, I'm now going to make the transition by saying one of the things that got drowned out by it yesterday was that she actually did take the opportunity of the news conference to take a position on Iran negotiations and to take a nice swipe at Senator Cotton and the other 46 Republican senators who signed that letter that you have written so eloquently about.
I would like to take this opportunity right now to thank Senator Tom Cotton and the 46 senators. It's been a good week for blogging at The Washington Post on this. So the open letter, I think, was revealed. Josh Rogan, I think, at Bloomberg was the first one to report on this that came out Sunday night. This sort of open letter, which basically says, oh, by the way, you know, just so you know, mullahs of Iran, President Obama is negotiating an executive agreement with you. And, you know, that executive agreement doesn't necessarily bind either us, the Senate, or future presidents to those, you know, terms. So just, you know, just thought you should know that.
Just in case you guys were wondering.
Actually, my favorite, I think hands down, the most arrogant part of that letter was the statement by them that, by the way, we'll be around for decades. Did you read the letter?
I missed that somehow.
Some of us, you know, will be around for decades. And I was actually gobsmacked by that, because whatever you could say about the sort of changing norms of political discourse in Washington, I had always thought that it was a given that politicians don't brag about the fact that they're likely to be reelected. Even if it's actually true, that's just one of those things you don't do. And so I was genuinely shocked when I read that in the letter.
Well, I think actually in some ways the most interesting way to see this letter is as the sort of coming of age announcement of Cotton and his group of House members moved to the Senate. But before we get to that, maybe we should spend at least a second on the actual policy implications of it.
Right.
So there has been, you know, a kind of interesting discussion about, are Republicans right? Is this a treaty? Does the Senate have, you know, is it in fact constitutionally necessary for the Senate to pronounce on an agreement that the United States makes with Iran?
Right. That's an easy answer. And my understanding is the easy answer is no. That this is an executive agreement. It's an executive agreement that does not, you know, is not under the purview of the 1961 arms control legislation that does mandate that these sorts of arms control treaties would have to go to the Senate because the U.S. isn't cutting any of its arms.
I have been surprised, Dan, I agree with everything you said, but I have been surprised at the number of progressive scholars who disagree and that this
really
seems to tap into this broader conversation about Congress's role in foreign policy and that you have
right
thinkers who say, well, you know, yes, we think this letter was embarrassing and wrongheaded and we think Congress should have a say. And I've been thinking, I mean, again, I don't see legally where you get a toehold on that, but it's probably important to really look at just how much angst about the congressional executive balance this is.
I would say there's two issues. The first one is the legal issue. And there, I think, I just simply don't see a case for, you know, I mean, eventually Congress will have to vote on some of the issues in terms of if the deal includes, you know, lifting sanctions that were congressionally mandated, then, yeah, eventually, you know, the president will have to go to Congress. I think you have to separate the legal issue from the political issue. And there I do think, you know, I think the letter was ridiculously stupid. I think the Republicans in Congress do have a somewhat better case to make for why it is they've gone down this road, which is to say that they are genuinely upset. And this is actually something I believe we talked about in a previous Blogging Heads, where I pointed out that on a whole host of issues, you know, climate change with China, immigration, the opening to Cuba, and now the, you know, potentially the nuclear deal with Iran, the executive branch has basically said, we don't need Congress. Now, I understand the sort of short-term tactical reasons for why they've done that. And in some cases, I think, you know, particularly on the Iran deal, there might even be precedent for doing that. I mean, previous deals, you know, let's say with Libya, for example, also didn't require an act of Congress. Or the 1994 Budapest Memorandum didn't require Congress to get involved. But I think there is this genuine concern about, you know, the idea that the Congress should actually act as a check and balance against untrammeled executive branch power, which I know from someone who might be a fan of the Obama administration's policies might be frustrating, but nonetheless is sort of a fact of life.
Yeah, no, it's just been fascinating to me that people have, that there's so much more discussion of this, the Iran issue, than, you know, at the same time this week, Congress is looking at the authorization for use of military force against, against ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Which, by the way, is one where, in fact, I think it's, Congress should have a much greater role. That's, you know.
Yeah. But it's getting, yeah. I mean, it's getting attention sort of among those who have to deal with it on the Hill, but there's almost no public discussion of it.
Right.
And, you know, one of the funny things that's happening around it is that Republicans on the Hill think that it binds the executive too much. Democrats tend to think that it doesn't bind it enough. So
right.
You actually, and, you know, the administration, to its credit, listened to the concerns that were being expressed by a lot of Democrats and not just the left, but you had sort of a coming together of the left and the constitutional purists, you know, sort of meeting in the person of Senator Kaine. And they came back, you know, with an effort to sort of split the baby and give everybody some of what they wanted, and to actually put in some limitations on executive war waging power, which is upsetting the Republicans and don't go far enough for the Democrats. But, you know, looking at that, where you've had a kind of quiet but intense debate about the role of Congress in waging war, and you actually see a little bit of movement on it, and then you compare it to all the light, heat without light on the Iran issue, and it's interesting.
No, I think so. And what's, again, and I wrote about this today. As I said, what is striking to me is that 2 months ago, you could have made the case that the GOP had a distinct advantage on foreign policy questions. I mean, if you took a look at the polling, President Obama's foreign policy was not considered terribly popular. The Republicans had won a pretty resounding midterm, victory. The Republicans were now going to control both chambers of Congress. There were a whole host of issues, Keystone, the immigration question, Iran, U.S. relations with Israel, where, in fact, it wasn't just Republicans that had an issue with Obama. It was a fair number of Democrats as well. And God, have they screwed this up. It is striking to me the extent to which their attempt to somehow be relevant on foreign policy has been, I think, an unmitigated disaster. I don't think the Netanyahu, invitation or speech went nearly as well as they had hoped. And I think this letter, wound up backfiring to the point where there was that incredible article in the Daily Beast. Did you read this by Tim Mak?
Oh, no. I thought you were going to say that the New York Daily News called them traitors on
That's
their
also
cover.
One. And
when,
yeah, the New York
when
Daily,
the Daily
News,
News calls you a traitor, you are not winning with your target audience.
Right. No, the back and filled by the Daily Beast was various Senate staffers saying, we just thought this was a lighthearted attempt, to get the administration's attention, and gosh, they have no sense of humor, which, it's anonymous sourcing, so you do have to discount it somewhat. But still, if that's your defense, it's a really bad one. And it also contradicts what you've seen in some of the others. My favorite quote, I think of this, was in Politico, where John McCain was asked why he signed it. And I got to say, I was actually genuinely shocked that McCain signed it, given that it was supposedly sent to Iran. And McCain's answer made me wonder if McCain had actually read the letter, where he basically said, yeah, I read it, thought it looked reasonable. I signed a lot of stuff.
Of course he hadn't read the letter.
Yes, well, yes.
But this is, I think, one of the really interesting political dynamics here, which is that, the fact that they've had to back off it, the fact that a number of signers have backed off it, the fact that of who didn't sign it.
Yeah, which is Bob Corker, who's the sort of ranking Republican.
Who's the chairman of Senate Foreign Relations.
Chairman of Senate Foreign Relations, and Jeff Flake, and who else? I can't remember.
Susan Collins.
Right.
Rand Paul.
No, Rand Paul did sign it.
Paul did sign it.
Although my favorite, this came on Twitter today. Rand Paul apparently in testimony today told John Kerry, I signed the letter that was addressed to Iran, but really I was trying to communicate to President Obama, which, just as like the total high school equivalent. So basically foreign policy has become a massive exercise in passing notes at study hall.
Right. So Coates was another one who didn't sign it. Hmm. Who
Lisa Murkowski, I don't believe.
Murkowski. And there's one more who may not be running again. Sessions, maybe?
I don't know. It was only seven. 47 of them did sign.
Well, but the math is important, right?
Yeah, because, and also no Democrats, obviously.
So. Yeah, no Democrats, only 47. Some of the 47 edging away from that. So what does that tell you? That you probably, if you handle yourself right, you're not going to face a veto override on something related. Should you be?
Oh, it's worse than that. I think the letter itself, that was a point that was made in the New York Times story today on this, which is you can argue the letter itself dramatically increased the odds that a veto by President Obama will stand.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
And that's so. I mean, if you want to talk about this as standard effects, I've been writing about this for the whole week. I would say there are two somewhat contradictory effects. The first is I take Suzanne Maloney, who knows more about Iran than I'll ever, was forgotten more about Iran than I will ever know, is more pessimistic than I am. And she makes the case that this genuinely could sort of embolden the hardliners in Iran to say, see, there's no point in making a deal. They're never going to honor the terms, which, if so, meant that the letter actually would have been successful. Because let's face it, the whole purpose of this letter is to scupper any chances of an Iran deal. I would sort of push back and say the letter might actually increase the odds that there's a negotiated deal, because it basically signals to the Iranians that, this is your last chance at a deal. And it's not like I think, they're terribly afraid of a no deal scenario, but I think they want to I think there are significant, elements within Iran's government that want to reach an agreement as well. And the other thing I would say bluntly, though, is that the content of the letter, I think, is actually incorrect. I mean, it's technically correct. The president or Congress could, you know, overturn the agreement. I think in actual practicality, there is zero chance of that happening, because no incoming president is going to want to revoke an agreement that is not just between the United States and Iran, but between the P5 plus one and Iran. So if you revoke the agreement, you're not just, you know, setting off a conflict with Iran, you're pissing off Britain, France, and Germany, and that's not going to go down terribly well either.
Well, the other reason that it's not going to be reversed is that, you know, previous administrations, including the George W. Bush administration, looked at the options and concluded that, you know, some combination of containment and negotiations was the way to go. And, you know, barring Ted Cruz picks Tom Cotton as his running mate and they win, you're going to have a Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs who look at president and say, no, this is your best option. So
the only way, I'll do it this way, the only scenario where I could see it actually getting scuppered in 2017 would be if you had an overwhelming GOP victory, in which you have a president, but you also have a GOP dominated Senate and House, in which case I could see a scenario whereby it's the congressional Republicans that pass something to say, you have to revoke this. And then the sort of president can passively say, I didn't reverse it. It was what Congress did.
Well, and to be fair, the Iranians also get a vote here in that you could have a deal and then you could have debate about how it's being adhered to.
Right, which I think is that actually, if there's a way in which this is going to die, that's the way I would predict it, which it dies, which is that it turns out they don't quite adhere to the terms or there's some back and forth. But I think in some ways this ties back to your initial point about concern about the sort of, you know, balance between the branches of government. Politically, as I've said, I think if, you know, Obama inks a deal, that deal is going to hold post-January 2017. And I can understand why that would then bother a fair number of both progressives and conservatives about the notion that basically the executive can do anything that they want and there's no check on that from Congress. So I actually do get that concern. I think the letter is a signal of congressional weakness rather than congressional strength on this.
Well, I want to back up to one other political consequence here, because everything we've just said about how this backfired, what we think it will lead to in terms of once a deal is reached. But at the same time, I'm not sure, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what its effects are for Mr. Cotton. But if you assume that he and some number of his new Senate colleagues are going to choose to play the way that the sort of minority within the Republican majority chose to play in the House, they are going to sort of not care when Corker says, now let me sit you down and explain how junior members behave in the matters of foreign affairs. And so it wouldn't at all surprise me to see, you know, that Cotton not only doesn't abashedly change his ways, but that we see more of this rather than less.
Right.
So I view it, you know, from purely within a domestic politics standpoint, that we should expect to see more of this kind of turbulence and incoherence on our issue set. And, you know, one way this is going to happen very soon, by the way, is on the budget, where you have sort of the Republican center, the Democratic center, and the Pentagon all begging and pleading to get the Pentagon out from under sequester and spend more money on it. Mm-hmm. And you have, to the amazement of everyone, including their colleagues in their own party, group of Republican hardliners saying, no, we don't want to spend any more money. And if not spending more money on Pentagon is the price of not spending more money domestically, hey, that's not spending more money. And
although
we don't really care about ISIS.
I would say I don't think Tom Cotton is among that group. I'm not sure.
No, he's not. But the tactics and the attitudes toward leadership are very similar. And the sort of your calculus and my calculus of what's a win and a loss is not the same as their calculus about what shows their core constituency that they're staying true to their values.
This was the content of something I wrote today in the Post, which is that I could have used this, but I will call it the crucifixion of the Senate, as in Ted Cruz, which is the way in which you now advance your brand in Congress is not really by passing legislation, because not a lot of legislation is passed nowadays. it's by, you know, particularly if you're a Republican member of Congress, it's by being a disruptor. It is by, you know, standing athwart government and yelling stop. The one thing that does give me pause here, and you know, I'd be curious about your take on this, is that I think by and large, the Republicans sort of, you know, since the Tea Party, you know, movement kind of swept through Congress, you can argue they have largely done this on domestic policy issues. You know, questions about the budget, taxation, and so forth. And those are areas where you can argue that Congress is generally viewed as a co-equal, if not even the more dominant branch, when it comes to making policy vis-a-vis the executive branch. Foreign policy is somewhat different. The Constitution stacks the deck in favor of the executive branch there, and not to mention tradition and Supreme Court rulings and so on and so forth. So I do wonder if this will play as well on the foreign policy side as it you know, potentially might have on the domestic side. Not that I think it played terribly well there. I mean, it'll obviously warm the cockles of sort of diehard GOP partisans, but I think there's going to be a fair number of people that are not going to find this. In some ways, it's self-defeating precisely because there were areas of foreign policy where Democrats were actually in league with Republicans against the Obama administration. And I think these kinds of tactics are going to sever that possibility.
Well, what you're saying sounds very like the things that people said about the House Republicans on domestic and fiscal issues when they started doing this stuff.
And it still worked for them.
And it still worked for them. And, you know, they were primaried and they mostly didn't lose. You know, the Republican establishment tried to push back on them and failed. You know, Justin Amash is still there. And the other sort of interesting thing is that the pressure on them of, you know, primarying them, taking away their committee assignments, actually led them to cooperate more with each other so that you had, over time, a little bit less of the sort of one man raging against the machine and a little bit more, coordination, which has led to some significant, achievements from their point of view, even if in some cases it just looks like gumming things up really embarrassingly if you have a different point of view about what you're in Washington to do. So I wouldn't assume at all that the sort of traditional attitudes about Congress staying out of foreign affairs are going to deter these folks. I think, you know, the defense budget is one huge area. Another that's interesting is the sort of intelligence, NSA, Patriot Act renewal set of issues where, you know, they've tried in the House and you had, you know, sort of a small caucus in the Senate and haven't been very effective. We'll see if that changes. And then just, I think, actually, rather than sever Democratic-Republican cooperation, what this environment does, and this is what I do for a living over at New America, is that you look at it not as a Republicans partnering with Democrats, but you look for it on an issue-by-issue entrepreneurial basis. Who's out there who agrees with me on Iran? And so you have Rand Paul and Barbara Boxer doing Iran legislation together. Who's out there that agrees with me on Patriot Act reform? So that we're entering, you know, these guys, in a funny way, make partisanship matter less, even as they bring it to new heights.
I'm not sure I agree with that last part. I mean, in the sense that, in some ways, the way the Iran thing has played out, I guess the interesting question going forward, if you're right, you will still see a fair amount of bipartisanship on, let's say, Bob Corker's bill to promote congressional review of any sort of Iran negotiation. And in some ways, the proof will be going forward. But I do have to concede that I think you're right that as much as I thought there would be damage caused from, let's say, I don't know, shutting down the government in 2013, there clearly wasn't less than a year later. The one counter to that I would have is that was during a midterm election and we're about to have a presidential election. And so turnout will be greater.
And different.
And that does not necessarily favor in a way that favors the Republicans less than is commonly the case with midterms. So, you know, there is a yin and yang to this. The other thing I think that's important is that in some ways, a lot of the sort of congressional acts on foreign policy amount to nothing more than trolling. In that I don't think Netanyahu's speech really changed the dynamics of the Iran negotiation, and I'm somewhat dubious that this letter will have done so as well. I think I fall into the very small category of people who thought the letter was stupid, but on the other hand, also did not think it was the greatest, you know, did not think it was like, you know, oh my God, it's just so horrendous, you know, as someone somewhat familiar with previous congressional attempts to interfere in foreign policy. It is interesting to me the extent to which Democrats, I think, have seized upon this as a effective way to critique the Republicans in Congress. But I don't know if even maybe this is considered successful by their partisans. You know, you have some people who might think that these are great victories, doing things like this letter. But I think I would disagree with those people about the color of that dress too.
Yeah. So I'll pause for just two things there. And I think, you know, victory is the wrong word, but in any kind of organizing.
You're clearly not a Republican, Heather. Victory is everything. No, sorry, go ahead.
In any kind of organizing, you have to do things that keep your membership excited.
Right.
And so if you look at, and this in here, you know, I agree with your basic sort of cynicism about the importance of this letter. That, you know, this is just a device to jack up the base, to get people excited about, you know, oh, look, isn't Barack Obama bad? Look at the bad thing he's doing this time. Look how strong and permanent and going to be here forever we are. You know, it's like a fundraising letter.
Yeah.
So that's point one. And then point two, just a little bit of self-promotion about a piece I have coming out in the American Prospects next issue, looking at how the difference in turnout between midterm years and presidential years, and specifically differences in female turnout, intersect with different ways that men and women respond to anxiety and fear and threats of having your head cut off by terrorists or having your shopping mall bombed. And so something that I had not realized until I started researching for this article, female voter turnout in Colorado fell by more than 3%.
Okay. You mean from 2012 to 2014?
Yeah. Okay. And in Virginia, Mark Warner, you know, who wasn't supposed to have a tight race and then
he had an extremely tight race with Reince Priebus. Yep.
He lost 12% of the female vote from his previous run. And basically, if Democrats don't get 55% of the women's vote of women's vote, they don't win. And looking at how that goes up and down and why and how Republicans in this last cycle used worries about ISIS, worries about Ebola to shift sort of small but significant numbers of voters. Just because you mentioned it, it's something that we don't think about often enough, but it is a big deal. And so with that, perhaps we pivot to the country that's having an election next Tuesday.
Oh, that's right. Yes, Israel. I will turn it back to you for your thoughts on this. The only thing I will note is that from what I have seen, it turns out that Benjamin Netanyahu's speech not only did not help him, it might have mildly hurt him with the Israeli electorate. Or, I mean, it's tough maybe it had zero impact. But my understanding, I mean, the polls have been trending against Netanyahu's coalition.
There's some wonderful stuff in the Israeli press this morning of anonymous Likud, which is Netanyahu's party, anonymous Likud officials taking to the media to say, we think our guy's going to lose. We thought that him speaking before Congress would seal the deal, but it didn't work the way we thought it didn't work the way it was supposed to. So it is interesting, you know, as we were just saying about Iran, where you seem to have had a governing conservative party that made a massive miscalculation about the nature of its or the desires of its centrist audience members.
Although this is where the cynic in me wonders if those Likud leaks are designed to bring back people who would otherwise vote for the sort of much smaller, even more extreme right-wing parties to think, oh my God, Likud could actually lose. We got to go back and vote for Likud.
Well, actually, the real problem Likud has is leakage to the smaller new centrist parties. Hmm. So, you know, the where at one point, and the other thing that people are saying is not to place too much faith in Israeli polling. So you could have any outcome from Netanyahu and the far right parties together hook up and make a coalition. To the center left and center parties are able to make a clear coalition. to nobody is able to make a clear coalition. And it comes down to either you bring in the religious parties or you bring in the Arab parties. And really, you know, every poll the last few days that has come out shows Zionist Home, which is the center left.
What used to be Labor.
Yeah. You know, gaining and you know, Bibi as far down as he's ever been, but there's some question about how reliable in you that is. So
I was going to say, go ahead.
Because it's not our not either of our expertise, and viewers can and should go and there's lots of good stuff online about all of this. But what is really interesting is how Washington is preparing itself or not preparing itself for the results. And you saw.
Oh, do tell.
Well, you saw a very interesting move this week, which is that Rob Malley will now be the senior NSC official responsible for the Middle East. Okay. And for viewers who don't remember Rob, who's a former colleague and a friend and someone I like and admire very much, but he was actually pushed off the Obama campaign in 08. Because Republicans made a big deal about him having written an article. He worked in the Clinton administration and was present at the 2000 Y talks that failed. And Rob co-wrote an article basically saying it wasn't all the Palestinians' fault that Y failed. And he is viewed as more, he's viewed as, how do you put, I'm choosing my words very carefully here. He is well regarded by both Israelis and Palestinians, and he is better regarded by Palestinians than some members of the Republican pro-Israel community are comfortable with. How's that?
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I think what we need desperately is to have a future Blogging Heads. We need to have one of the editors write subtitles for what you and I say. You know, so like you're saying something that is permissible within DC policy discourse, and then the subtitle will say Rob is much friendlier to the Palestinian, or whatever the actual thing you're trying to signal is. I think that would be awesome.
Right, but and also someone in the administration leaked to the Israeli press that the administration was preparing a new Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative, mm-hmm. And quote, its contours would depend on the results of the election, which is sort of like you think. Yeah. So the administration at least wants Israelis and Palestinians to think that it has something up its sleeve.
This, you know, let me put it this way. This does tie back into the larger, to the debate we were having before about the sort of perception of success by congressional Republicans. Let's assume for the moment, or let's postulate that Netanyahu actually loses. Would that be something that in fact would be damaging to, I mean, that would actually hurt. I would assume the Republican members of Congress from the point of view of their partisans, because it would be hard not to conclude that the speech and the invite and so on and so forth didn't play a role in that.
Well, and there does seem, and we should also say here, and I know this is something we say fairly often, that when we talk about Republican, pro-Israel Republicans constituents, we are talking about evangelical Christians.
Right.
And the funny thing is the period in which evangelical Christians have gotten attached to Israel in the particular political way they are now attached to Israel, they have only had Bibi. So nobody knows what those groups and their members, how they're going to understand an Israeli election in which the prime minister changes, because it hasn't happened since we got to this particular place. So I do, you know, my worry is that it is sort of the version of the way that some segments of America have just kind of been unable to deal with an Obama presidency. Mm. And you get, I mean, you get all kinds of sort of, this isn't the real Israel or something. So that's one thing I worry about. The other thing that I think will happen if Netanyahu loses that maybe people have not thought through sufficiently is there's going to be this, oh, yay, everything wonderful is now going to happen, and you can all have a pony, and
right.
In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, you never change your socks. And
that's,
you know,
the
Israeli public has grown increasingly cynical and skeptical. The Palestinian
public, conservative.
The Palestinian public has sort of gone beyond cynical and skeptical to, you know, having an active distaste for its own leaders. Right. So, The people who stagger to the table when, you know, should an Obama administration invite them to the table are going to have less legitimacy with their own publics than maybe at any time in all the time the U.S. has been trying to broker peace. So yeah. People need to really rein in their expectations if Netanyahu loses.
All right, so bookmark this for next week. Of course, if Netanyahu wins, then, you know, we will... It'll turn out the speech was a great idea, in which case Heather's will be proven right, as is usual. Right. I unfortunately need to get going, but this is a pleasure as always. I really want this subtitle version. We gotta pitch this to Blogging Heads. I think that would be awesome.
Only if we also have one where we talk about academic stuff and they subtitle you.
That would be great too. I will take that wager. That would be fantastic.
All right,
we could have
coming
half,
soon.
Like academic discourse, half DC discourse, and with subtitles.
That would be great.
All right, pleasure as always.
Take care, Dan.
Bye.